Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to another episode of our podcast, Care in Action. And our guest today is Rasmus Stur Jakobsen, the CEO of Care Denmark, so one of my appreciated colleagues. As always, I introduce him very briefly. Rasmus has over 20 years of experience in the humanitarian sector, having held senior leadership positions at the World Food Programme, the Red Cross, and the Danish Refugee Council. Currently, he is at CARE, obviously, and he also serves on the executive board of CARE International, where he helps shape the global strategy of our confederation. So, Rasmus, thank you very much for joining us. And let's jump right into our conversation. And we have heard that you had various senior positions before CARE, but what else did you do? What people might find astonishing, or have you always been a humanitarian worker?
Thank you so much, Andrea. Thanks a lot for the invitation. I've been looking forward to it. No, I think what I'll mention or highlight here is perhaps my it's still within my work life and work career, but my many, many years working with displacements and forced displacement. So for 10 years now, and having been with CARE, I worked with the climate agenda and particularly the issue of climate adaptation. But prior to that, working with the Refugee Council and with the WFP as well, the World Food Programme and so forth, it's really been the issue of forced displacement that's sort of been my through line somehow. And what I'm finding increasingly interesting in my work life and in my career is that I'm finding that these two paths are intersecting and increasingly crossing each other. As so and so more people already these days, but also when we're looking at the foresights into the future, are being displaced because of climate issues. So somehow I've gone in my work life a little bit sort of full circle with working with displacement, working with climate, and now increasingly working with climate-induced displacement.
And if you look back on your long career, I think I might say so, apart from the fact that you talk now about that this is very intersection of humanitarian displacement, forced displacement, and the climate crisis, what else did change most from your perspective?
Well, I'm thinking, looking at displacement, I think that it's terrifying and of course very worrisome that the numbers, despite the wealth that increases in the world, that the numbers of displacements are still going up. So has been steadily rising since the Second World War. So even though that we've had lulls in armed conflicts around the world, there's still, when you look at a number of years in the past and also looking at trends into the future, the numbers will continue to rise. And that, of course, I think is extremely worrisome. And I think that the recent big humanitarian crisis that we are all very familiar with on Sudan and Gaza and Ukraine and so much is only really sort of underlining and underpinning that big change in the world that we are seeing at the moment politically, which is the root cause of these major displacement crises.
Because I tend to look at it and think that the narrative changed dramatically, how also the European Union, but not only the Union, more the governments, the European governments, it's less the European Union, I have to say, it's more the European governments, how they look at displacement, migration, and how they frame it. And the narrative is getting worse and worse. And sometimes I think this is only my impression, because those people, they always had serious problems in getting crossing into wealthier countries. And so maybe it's only my perspective in history that I think nowadays it is extremely bad how it is framed. What is your take on that?
No, I completely agree. And I think that we just had the example during the last couple of weeks with all of the migrants from Morocco wanting to enter Europe via Spain. And we saw how quickly and how fragile the European Union is also. I mean, we experienced that with the Syrian refugees back in 15 as well, where many were threatening a collapse of the European Union back then. And we saw here how quickly 22 countries were mobilizing against Spain that was then capable within a couple of days to demonstrate leadership and tackle the issue and in a very responsible manner, but the threat was there, was perceived very real, and so many countries within the European Union supposedly to have each other's back and stand together were all of a sudden in strong opposition to each other. So I think again these crises are really, I mean, they are politically so important for these politicians in their own national agendas, forcing them to go out so strongly, so quickly, so verbally against one another when these crises happen.
I thought that this is not Europe as its best. If we factor in that 65 people are drowning and some have not been found yet, and this is not shocking us so much, it's much more shocking to us, the fact that people want to come to Europe and the reasons why they want to come, I think they are quite in the background, because of course not everybody is looking only to flee its own government, but for better economic possibilities. And this might be also driven by climate change, right? Because yes, many absolutely. Of them are farmers. I think the least of them have had the chance to have higher education. So I think most of them are fishermen and farmers.
Yeah. No, I think that's an extremely important and true point. I think when we look more broadly at the Mediterranean and how many thousands of people that have died in their attempt to cross, and the type of, way above 30,000 people have died and have drowned in the Mediterranean, and the kind of cynicism somehow that exactly as you're pointing out, this is not met with remorse and sorrow and afterthought. It's rather met with strengthened border control and a kind of a cynicism that we can live with and we can bear those losses if that is what it takes to preserve the status quo or our way of life. And I think that that's a high price to pay.
So do I, and I'm not naive. I don't think we should open the borders for everybody. I want to be very clear in these points, because some of our listeners might think, this is typical NGO now. But I think that we as Europe, we hold up at least verbally the human rights very highly, and we should not get that hard ourselves vis-a-vis other human beings of not even have a moment of mourn for more than 65 people. And I'm sure there are more to be found. And now in summer, many of us prefer to spend the summer at the Mediterranean. So I think this is a bit bizarre, but maybe it's just me and Rasmus who think that this is a bit bizarre. So let us move on. We talked a lot about the climate change, the impact of climate change. And sometimes, or quite often, it is framed as a humanitarian crisis, which is also true. But is that framing really inclusive of the wealthy nations? Is it political failure, or is it a natural disaster that we are talking, or is it a combination of both? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and I think the latter, that it's probably both, and it's probably best for us, for all of us, to stay really attuned that both of those issues are at play. Because I fully agree that the language around a humanitarian disaster, when we talk about a humanitarian crisis, it's language of neutrality and impartiality and so on. And we talk about floods and droughts and so on. And that really doesn't explain a lot about, you know, why is it that we are finding ourselves in this situation. But clearly, if there is, when the flood hits in Pakistan, for example, or drought hits in the Horn of Africa, of course, people need food, shelter, psychosocial support, aid, and so many other things. That is the humanitarian response at its best and in the heart of it. But again, as you were mentioning, why is it that we are increasingly seeing climate-induced displacement? Who are the responsible parties behind this? And I think it's becoming more and more difficult to raise and hold accountable those responsible. I experienced this in the annual climate negotiations, and maybe we can come back to that a little bit later in our discussion. But there is, of course, so many Western countries here with very unambitious climate agendas. And as long as the Western countries, including US, China, and Russia, are unambitious, then we will just continue to see an increase in the so-called humanitarian disasters.
What we see now in this summer, more than we saw it in the last summers, is that the problems and the impact is coming closer and closer to our own countries, because it's devastating what we see in the Mediterranean, what we see in Spain, in Canada, you name it. Everywhere we have these massive fires with an enormous impact, not only on the harvest, but also on the whole condition of the country. And of course, also a certain risk of human loss. We already saw many people dying in the fire. Do you think that many so-called northern countries will get a bit more sensitive to it, or will it increase the insensitivity vis-a-vis the so-called global south to say, okay, we have to fight the problems now ourselves. We don't listen any longer to your pleas and to the things that you want from us.
I think that when we experience these extreme heat waves during the summer, it is, of course, a stark reminder for everybody that that the problem of climate change and global warming hasn't gone away, which we've been thinking for at least a year now, or even a little bit longer. And I think that part of that forgetfulness is also that it's so difficult for us to keep too many big global agendas in play at the same time. So when we have a lot going on in Ukraine, and there's a lot of attention to Trump, when we have a Gaza conflict in Gaza and so on, then naturally sort of the climate issue drops off the agenda, and it lurks there in the background. It of course doesn't mean that global warming stops or it doesn't develop while we are considering and discussing other important things. And then it sort of picks up when there is a pause in some of these other global agendas and takes center stage. I fear, because I think we've been seeing some of these huge fires and massive heat waves across Europe before without that having too much of an impact on Western countries' climate policy. I think it will take something, how can we say, without it being sort of too awful or too perverse even, but it needs to be worse. It needs to be worse than that. My very personal opinion is that it takes an even bigger crisis for the climate agenda to sort of really come back on top of the political agenda. And I don't know, of course, what that would be, but I think it takes, you know, something big, something awful, where everybody will wake up again and say, we cannot allow something like this to happen.
I'm sure you often heard it too, but I very often hear, so we have to tackle that on a global level, because this is by far, it doesn't make a big difference if Austria uses only electric cars as an example, or Europe and the rest does not. But when I look at the quality of air, for instance, in Vienna at the moment, where all the parameters are really bad for us, then I think it would be a good first step, or second or third step, to say, okay, we start in our own markets, and the more people do, the better for all of us, because it's we can do also something useful to clean our own air, even if there are borders and our neighbors should do the same. But we saw in China, for instance, or in India, that large cities act if they don't have a choice. And as you said, in many cities in China were not breathable any longer. So the government had to react and do something. And I hope you're not right, but it sounds like you have a good chance to be right, that it's not bad enough so far in Europe that steps are taken. Because what we see on a regular basis, now everybody complains. And in October, when the temperature goes down, it's forgotten until May next year, which is really a bit of a disaster. So in Austria, we have been told until this year that we have enough water, that we need not worry, that we do everything fine. As far as I know, Denmark calls itself also a climate leader. So this is something that you do, and also Austria does that, and Vienna in particular. But from where you sit in Denmark, is that an earned reputation, or is it something, is it more a bit of public relation, or is it a mixture again?
And without sounding wanting to sound too diplomatic, it's not my intention, but it is probably a bit of a mix on that. I think that that Denmark, to some extent, has earned a good reputation. We've had some we played some important political roles as it relates to the COP, the annual climate negotiations. For example, when it comes to the issue of loss and damage. And loss and damage is an issue of how do we financially compensate those countries that have lost a lot due to climate change. Let's imagine, for example, a big flood in Mozambique that destroys infrastructure and hospitals and so on. And Mozambique has not been contributing to global warming. So, of course, rightly they think they would be asking you know, wealthier countries that are contributing more to global warming, saying, please help pay for these losses. So that sort of whole concept is what is called loss and damage. And Denmark was very active politically in setting that agenda, and was the one of the first countries that also put money into a loss and damage fund and so on. So I think that there's some hard-earned political credibility that that Denmark can be proud of. And then there's also, as instance, some a little bit of greenwashing and a little bit of very sophisticated branding in it. Denmark has had a national climate policy that has been very dependent on sophisticated sort of carbon capture, new technologies, carbon capture and so many other things that that they betted on that hasn't really materialized. So it's now confronted with a problem of living up to its own goals and targets because some of these technologies hasn't really delivered. So I think that Denmark is still sort of in the upper half, in the upper third, maybe even of countries around the world, but still certainly also has something to do and deliver in our national context. There's been it's been very difficult, for example, in the Danish political landscape to take the big discussion with our farming industry, for example. It's one of those where that is very difficult across Europe, where we have very, very strong unions and interest organizations, but where we also see a lot of the CO2 emissions. And it's the same issue in Denmark, and we haven't really found a way yet for how to tackle that.
I think that's really true for many European countries. It's certainly true also for Austria. I think that Austria does a lot of interesting and good things, but when it comes to earning, generating income, about winter tourism, for instance, ski lifts and all the things that we have loved so much, it is, of course, very much driven by economic interest, which is on one side understandable, but on the other side, I think it is still time to act because we see the impacts in summer and in winter, because in winter we are lacking snow and rainfall. Plus, it is also warmer than it was in winter. And in summer, Vienna is one of the hottest cities at the moment. We mounted up 40 degrees last week, 41. Some thermometers showed 44, 45 in the sun. This is not normal. And this has been staying with us for weeks, and you have heard it for sure too, that Europe is the continent who warms much faster than all the others. So I think some smart solutions should come out of Europe, and we have in Austria still very, very strong discussions about wind energy, which some of our provinces prefer not to put in on top of the mountains because they think it doesn't look beautiful. One can think whatever you want. But in the end, wind energy is something, an alternative resource that we should not stop thinking about. And when we build a ski lift, we are not so much worried how it looks like. But with wind energy, this is something that is really, really a big fuss. And we have many of it in eastern Austria, but in the western part of Austria, you have provinces where you don't find a single one. So I think all of us have a lot to do still, and also convince civil society, who also has a say, which is not always that clear. But listening to your talking about the loss and damage principle, and you mentioned Mozambique and Care Austria and Care Denmark. We are both working in Mozambique, who is constantly under disaster, constantly under political unrest and civil war in many parts. So what asking for loss and damage or asking for more humanitarian aid, isn't the result somehow the same? Isn't it what we see, that resources are declining now in humanitarian arena? We see it massively. We talk about 50 to 60% loss of humanitarian funding globally. Plus, we see not a very strong appetite, let's put it like that, that the loss and damage principle is really funded, which increases the number of people who will need humanitarian aid. Aren't we going in circles a little bit?
Yes, I think we are. And it's really frustrating that we are, but we are. And I think that there's a couple of things here that I would highlight. I think that I'm attending every year the annual COP, the climate negotiations, and the climate negotiations have been going on for now plus 30 years. So we are attending COP 31 next year in Turkey, and then it's COP 32 in Ethiopia the year after that. So we've had so many meetings now between parties with different opinions, trying to compromise and find ways forward, that I think, and we've had so many of these meetings now, that I think that we've sort of reached almost a peak point where every argument, where every dollar has been turned and every argument has been used and countered and so on, to the extent where it's really, really difficult to come up with new ideas, new solutions, surprise each other with arguments. It's been so tried and tested over so many times that now we're almost stopped. And there's nothing new really to be said. It's all been said before. There's no new money to come into the mix. We tried and tried and tried for so many years, and somehow, you know, it's not materializing, and there's no indication that it will in the future. And hence the whole discussion now on climate is therefore moving from the more sort of principle than financial discussion and setting new targets and new standards and so on to an action track. So let's do something about it. Now seems to be the agenda, but let's do something about the let's do something about it agenda also requires money. And this is simply where we struggle. And the issue that struggles most with the lack of with lack of funding is the whole, as we are discussing now, the loss and damage, which in, I agree essentially is humanitarian assistance and reconstruction. But it's also the issue of climate adaptation. So how do we help people and countries adapt and survive the increased global warming? And the issue why it's so difficult to find money for that is that we can't attract private investments into that space. We can attract private investments into the space of green energy, solar energy, and wind, and all of those things. There we can find private investors. They can see that there's money in that over the long haul.
Where there's a probability of return on investment, right?
Exactly. So where is that when we're talking about loss and damage? And, you know, when we're looking in Mozambique and we're looking at that poor farmer woman, you know, she's not a business case. She's not an investment sort of worthy somehow from a purely financial standpoint. Of course, she is from every other standpoint. And that's really the difficulty that we are confronted with now in terms of somehow seeing, I mean, attracting financing into that space. But you're absolutely right. We are going in circles, and there's no new money coming into the system. Quite the opposite.
Isn't that what organizations like CARE are doing mostly in their environmental programming to try to find adaptation possibilities and programs for thousands of people? Isn't that what CARE Denmark is mainly doing, with also with institutional funding? I think we are even together in one of large projects in Foster, if I'm right. So we are in a large consortium with many millions in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, looking for smart solutions for adaptation, which is funded by the European Union. And at the same time, all of our care organizations, if I may say so, are struggling also with the scarcity of resources and also to show the proven evidence that solutions can be sustainable and can also live for more than the project cycle. They can exist longer than a project cycle. So this is something that is really embarrassing somehow, because I, even if the EU now starts the Global Gateway, I'm really wondering how much private investors are in general attracted by finding solutions for people who are not feasible, who can't make their own business case simply because they are too small as farmers or too poor as persons, right?
Yes. And I think that when we look at, I completely agree. And therefore, it's so heartbreaking that so many countries increasingly are cutting back on aid. Mm-hmm. I think, Andrea, both you and I, we agree that, I mean, to the extent possible and as far out we can, we need to come up with solution also based on institutional money and aid money, that somehow has a market vehicle built inside it. So that can ensure the replication, that can ensure scale, that can ensure that the sustainability, the longer-term sustainability of a project, that without it, these types of projects will be completely independent on a continued and a renewed grant or a renewed sort of institutional financing. So to the extent that we can help women do businesses that strengthen their economy and so on, and it's increasingly sort of built on market mechanisms, that's really good. But then we do know that at a certain point we reach, and you can almost sort of draw a line in the sand in country X where that happens, where the market mechanisms simply no longer are at play, where the scale is so minimal that it's not worthwhile talking about investments and so on. Also, all of the humanitarian situations where this is not, you know, This is not an investment case, as we talked about just before. This is a matter of saving lives and so on. So there's so many, there's so many situations out there where we can't make the case that this is something that we can do with investor money somehow. But it needs to be, we are working, we are developing, we are piloting, we are innovating around how can we create, how can we really create more value from the single euro somehow? How can we invest it in the smartest possible way so it generates more? But only up to a certain point, then there is and will continue to be also a need for the for what you and I will call institutional brands, but these donut brands, simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And this reminds me a little bit of an intense discussion I had a few weeks ago at a global meeting in Geneva, where it was stated that the average humanitarian situation now lasts around 15 years. And it is not, I was told, it is not in the interest, obviously not, of institutional donors that such emergency situations stay that long and that people get more and more dependent on humanitarian aid. And my reflection on that was, and not only mine, but what we oversee, and we oversee it also in the discussion when we say there's no appetite for sustainable investment, is that we have nearly exclusively poly crisis. It's really rare that an earthquake, a quick onset, and then you can do the pattern that we did 20 years ago. The normal situation is that you have climate change, conflict, earthquake, flooding, whatever, all together. We have poly crisis. And what is neglected by many is that without peace and without peace building, it is really, really difficult to attract donors, investors, and sustainable, smart solutions. And we have a lot of knowledge about Nexus, and I don't know what, but the dimension, the third dimension of Nexus, the peace-building dimension, which would be the precondition for many things that we have talked about now, and we mentioned it even in Mozambique, it is simply not in place. And as long as this is not in place, it's not us as NGO who keep millions of people dependent in humanitarian aid in order to sustain our own business model, which is really absolute nonsense. It is more the situation that the world is in that keeps millions of people dependent on humanitarian aid, because nothing can take place without peace.
No. And isn't it interesting how little we invest in creating mm-hmm. peace compared mm-hmm. to how much yeah. we invest, in our national armies and sustaining war. And that's, I think, it's just a philosophical somehow interesting dilemma that once first the war machinery and the war language somehow is taking over, it's very, very difficult to stop that for both parties, domestically, politically, and for so many different reasons. Once the wheels are in motion, the efforts of peace really, really struggle. And we are investing so little in it, and financially, but also academically and intellectually and so on. And it's... Yeah.
Absolutely. And I would also like to hear your opinion, because there's not much out there. There are some studies, and we did an own podcast on it, but the environmental impact of war is massive. And nobody mentions that. I mean, it is very, and you have worked for the Red Cross. You know how expensive it is, not only cleaning mines out of a field for the sake of the people not dying working at the field, but also the poison, the chemicals, all the things, every drone, every rocket has an enormous impact. So in Syria and the Middle East, we have landscapes that are totally polluted only by weapons. Nobody talks about it. Isn't that interesting?
No. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And this somehow, is massive.
And it's massive. I was working with Mine Action and Mine Clearance for a couple of years also in the past. And we were clearing in Sri Lanka, for example, where we had unexploded ordnances in the forest, hidden in the forest, that had been moved around over the years and so on. And the only secure way of cleaning that was taking down the whole forest. So it means starting from point A and just clearing the whole thing. So huge environmental impacts from war, absolutely.
So this is why I think it is really important to mention it at least in a podcast where two experts talk to each other, that this is enormous and this has to be taken into consideration. So as a game changer somehow, and everybody knows where this conversation now turns to, AI is being pitched as a game changer for many things, but also for climate response. So what do you think about it?
I think that that's very true. And like in so many other fields within the climate area, there's we have some that are very, very optimistic and saying this can really change the whole debate and the reality on the ground for so many people and so on. I'm perhaps more skeptical. I certainly agree that some of the immediate benefits in terms of early warnings and satellite imagery and different types of analysis that can help make sure that a likely sort of natural disaster, that the consequences of that is being really minimized. I think that instruments there, that AI can really play a crucial role and hence save lives and infrastructure and so on. But I think also, as we are in these particular settings dealing with the most fragile countries and the most fragile people, the risk is certainly also there. I think in terms of what we are already seeing, this sort of this IT gap and this technology gap between the richer parts of the country and the poor parts, of the world and the poor parts of the world. And I think we'll see a copy paste of that also when it comes to AI, that some of these national organizations in Mozambique, in Ghana, and so on, will have a difficult time paying necessarily for the relevant tools, and the relevant instruments might not have the IT licenses and equipment and so on that it requires to really sort of be where they need to be at a comparable level with some of the Western organizations. I think we'll continue to see that some of the owners of the data, the vendors, will be the big beneficiaries. And so I think that sort of imbalance in financing and power and access will continue to remain, while at the same time that we will, I'm sure, see some very some operational benefits.
I hope that we will see some, and at least this is a first initial step from the side of Care Austria that we introduce the AI for Social Impact Award, where we have tailor-made suggestions and partly also solutions for AI usage done by mainly African, but also one Asian and one Latin American scientist, who say that the beneficial side of it, if you look at all the other aspects, the beneficial side of it can be there if vulnerable people get access to tools that they can use. Practical example, one of the prize winners has a solar-driven, invented a solar-driven panel that any farmer can take to the field, and then he gets the exact dosage that he needs for fertilizer, water, and so on. And when we hear now that fertilizer really is hard to access because the prices are enormous and people can't pay for it, is this something that might help also the environment if things are used in a more reasonable way? But of course, this brings with it that the whole level of education and the access to education and information rises. And I think this is also a new role that we as organizations like CARE have to play, because these things will be done with or without us. And if we are not being part of the discussion, this is expected also from the people we are working for, that we help them with tools maybe that they couldn't access without us, maybe.
I completely agree. I think that's a very important future role for us, because, I mean, whether we like it or not, and to a large extent, I think both you and I like it and are generally sort of optimistic about the uses and the advantages that can come from AI. But the role exactly, and we talk about leaving no one behind and making sure that technology gap doesn't widen and grow because of the introduction of AI, that this is yet, you know, another technology that is inaccessible for so many people that we work with. And then exactly our role would be to make that accessible for them, that they have the tools, the equipment, the intellectual knowledge and so on that it requires to benefit from it.
Also, we have to train and educate ourselves to use AI in a way that is not environmentally perfect, because this will not exist, but it can be super harmful or relatively harmful because the impact, and you need a lot of energy, but where the energy comes from, these are decisions that our governments and our civil societies have to make. And if it's not fueled by fossil energy, then, as I mentioned, this is a solar panel. This is then something that really might be a small game changer, at least.
Exactly.
Which is helpful. So we heard that you have attended lots of COPs every year, and I'm sure you have also, you're also reading for sure in Denmark. It's also published not only in Austria, that the COP per se is very highly criticized, because on the one hand, one has to be very clear, this is one of the few places where the world comes together and debates climate issues in a comprehensive manner. But on the other hand, we are all very much aware, and this is also published by Quality Media, that you have, I think there is nearly no other global meeting where you have so many private jets coming in for the attendance. I mean, this is not negative propaganda. People can see it. Yeah. Mm. So what has to change in the conversation from you as a regular attendee that is not going there by private chat, of course? What has to change in the conversation that really makes this group move forward? Because otherwise the world sits there, watches what happens, and we all lament afterwards, this costs only a lot of money and nothing comes out of it. What might be a game changer?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Andrea. And I think that, as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, I think that it's been going on now for so many years that we've had all of the discussion so many times that it's really difficult to come up with new ideas and new arguments. This about a game changer is so difficult to figure out what that could be somehow. But it's clear when attending the COP that the poorer and more vulnerable countries are deeply frustrated with the Western countries, that they're not living up to the promises in terms of the financial support that has been written into different agreements that they themselves have been signing and so on, but then in the end they're not delivering. Mm-hmm. And I think a game changer could be that the Western countries started to deliver on some of those promises. I think the whole negotiating sort of atmosphere and the trust in the room would be, if not restored, then at least improved compared to where it is now, where people are really sort of stuck and tucked into their own positions. And someone at some point will, of course, need to give, step forward, do something different, to open up the discussion again and open up for new possibilities. And I can't help think that the Western countries do have the best possibility and the best abilities to do that. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that increasingly, I think that there's a lot of minor groups, a mix of countries and companies that are forming small alliances and setting targets for themselves around, for example, preserving forests in the Amazon or, mm-hmm. or whatever.
We heard the good news, all of us, that the forest is not burned down that vastly than it was
under the
previous government, and that people understand more and more why they have to protect the Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. And somehow for me, I think that initiatives like that are super important. You talked about it also when you talked about the need for everybody to do their bit in an Austrian setting to clear the polluted air in Vienna, for example, because then people feel it and you can see it. I mean, when the COP negotiations are so high level, they're so bureaucratic and it's so political and so on, that it's almost meaningless to, you know, the everyday person somehow on the street, and why should I follow that? But that you can see, you can feel it, you can touch it, you can smell it. So I think that smaller alliances are increasingly becoming very, very critical for the COP process in terms of delivering visible results.
And if I'm now a younger listener to this podcast or a very engaged person, and the two of us have been working for decades, one can say, in the humanitarian sector and in international cooperation, what can we do together in a reasonable way that engages more than only the young people and gives us a very clear, positive life perspective? Because that's what it's all about. We all want to have a so-called good life, right? We want our children to be safe and we want to live in a peaceful environment and healthy environment.
Yeah. No, I think exactly. And I think that there are so many unhealthy trends caused by climate change. In a Danish context, we have many youth that are considering, and some have decided, you know, not to put children into this world because they they don't want to, you know. And some are being, depressed, really, in a very real sense, and feel at loss somehow because the issue is so big, and I'm just me, and my power is so limited. What can I do? And so I think that every little step, both from our own sort of mental health perspective, but certainly also for our from a national or even sort of community perspective, is worthwhile doing. I think your vote, of course, as always, is really, really important. So if it is an issue that one field is important, then I'm sure that there are, you know, really qualified politicians in your community and in nationally that has opinions about this. So it's also a matter of putting your vote where your mind is somehow. But I think that it is true, and you mentioned it earlier, Andrea, that that will only make, that will have limited impact. But that limited impact should absolutely not be underestimated. It can help clear the air in your community. It can help,
Save water.
Save water, for example. Yeah. Exactly, good example. Recycling stuff. There's a
drive
small
less,
shop.
Walk more.
Exactly. No, but these small things.
Simple
and
things.
There's a small repair shop for clothes and equipment just down my street here where, you know, volunteers are sitting and you can come in with your broken toaster or whatever, and then instead of throwing it out, they fix it. And, you know, these small, really concrete things, I think, are all good for you, for your community. And in the end, if enough of us are doing, you know, taking small steps, of course, then that becomes a big step.
So I think this was the perfect closing comment from our today's guest, Rasmus Sture-Jakobsen. Thank you, Rasmus, for having this interesting discussion. And it was a call to action. Don't oversee the small steps that you can take. And if you want to engage with an organization that really works on climate adaptation, then CARE is always a good choice. But I think all of you know that. Thank you, Rasmus. I hope that we will work also in the near future, very close together. And to the podcast community of Care in Action, have a good week and think about the small steps that are worth being taken. And don't forget, next week, it's again Care in Action podcast time.
So thanks a lot, Andrea. It's been wonderful discussing with you and looking forward to working a lot more on these issues together in the future.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.